Number six, Judicial Branch Administration, the Judicial Branch Contracting Manual. I'll have Mary introduce her panel.
Thank you. With me on my left is Evan Garber, our managing attorney responsible for our transactions and business operations unit within the Office of the General Counsel. And to my right is Todd Torr, one of our attorneys in that unit. The entire unit, just by way of a little bit of background, was swept into action to deal with the new California Judicial Branch contract law, which was the product of no discussion as far as we were aware of in the legislature, but it came on with SB 78. What we'll do right now is get into the PowerPoint, which is intended to provide at a rather high level what it is we're presenting to you, the council, with the recommendation that you adopt. So the topics that we're going to address today are the following. First, we'll provide some background about the new law and the requirements contained in the law about the adoption and publication of a judicial branch contract manual. Then we'll talk about the content of the proposed manual, and then we'll move to our specific recommendations that we have for the council. So first, the California Judicial Branch contract law. It was enacted in late March of this year. It established a brand new part of the public contract code. That part is part 2.5. It covers judicial branch entities defined to mean the courts, the council, the AOC, and the Habeas Corpus Resource Center. The judicial branch contract law has a number of requirements, but the fundamental requirement is that all contracts entered into by judicial branch entities beginning October 1st of this year must comply with public contract code provisions that speak to the procurement of goods and services that are applicable to state agencies and departments. So essentially, the new law is bringing the judicial branch under the requirements, the procurement requirements that are applicable to the executive branch agencies and departments. There are some very limited exceptions to this otherwise pretty broad application. And those exceptions are with regard to procurement and contracting for planning, design, construction, rehab, renovation, et cetera, of court facilities, trial court facilities, not appellate court facilities. So that is a very good and important exception or carve-out from the new requirements. The judicial branch contract law requirements that are pertinent today for today's discussion is that the council must both adopt and then publish a judicial branch contracting manual, which must be followed then by all judicial branch entities. So that is the, sort of the mothership of manuals is the judicial branch contract manual. I say mothership because all the individual judicial branch entities must then adopt their own local contracting manual. The judicial branch contract law requirements beyond just the adoption of the manual include that the council must report to the Joint Legislative Budget Committee and to the state auditor about judicial branch procurement activities beginning in February of next year. The council must make this report every 6 months. The Bureau of State Audits is required under the new law to conduct audits of the AOC, the courts, to assess the implementation of the new law. And just as an aside, we've been in discussions with the BSA about these new obligations because, you know, they're brought into the ambit of the law as well. Their thoughts are that they will look at this current fiscal year as the planning year as they try to figure out what it is they're supposed to do to implement their new legal obligations. And it will include identifying courts in each of the three categories, small, medium, and large, and have a pilot program to go out and start auditing courts with regard to their implementation of the new law. So turning to the Judicial Branch Contracting Manual itself, the deadline for adoption of the manual by statute is not until January of next year. So why are we coming to you now in August when there's so much going on? It's because of another peculiarity of the new law, which is that if the manual is not adopted by October 1, which is the operative date of the substantive requirements of the new law, then the state contracting manual and the state administrative manual will govern judicial branch entity contracting. And in our view, that is not a helpful situation. If the manual is not adopted by October 1, those two executive branch documents will govern until such time as the Judicial Branch Contracting Manual is adopted. So we are coming to you now with the thought being that if the Council were to adopt the manual, it would be in place effective October 1 and thereby not requiring judicial branch entities to be looking at the State Contracting Manual or State Administrative Manual for requirements. The requirements in terms of the content of the manual are the following. The provisions must be consistent with the Public Contract Code, and they must be substantially similar to the State Contracting Manual and the State Administrative Manual. Now, those two bullet points that you see that I just referred to are the legal requirements. The third bullet point is more aspirational, that the manual, well, it should be legally sound. That's not aspirational. We're going to make sure it's legally sound. But the other two, frankly, are aspirational, that it be business smart and user-friendly. It, frankly, is rather difficult to accomplish those aspirations because of the requirement that the content of the manual be substantially similar to the State Contracting Manual, which is in excess of 850 pages, and the State Administrative Manual, which I understand goes to thousands of pages. So it's quite a challenge to have the end product be both business smart and user friendly, but we have endeavored to make it so. As you can see where this is going, there's tension between the legislative objectives. And let me stop right there because I think that's something I neglected to say. The judicial branch contract law begins with a statement of legislative intent that the that in enacting this new California Judicial Branch contract law, the intent of the legislature is to achieve the objectives as set forth in the very first sections of the Public Contract Code itself, sections 100, 101, and 102. And those sections speak to the legislative findings and declarations that putting all public contract law in one code will make the law clearer and easier to find. It'll help clarify the law with respect to competitive bidding requirements. It'll help ensure full compliance with competitive bidding statutes as a means of protecting the public from misuse of public funds. It'll provide all qualified bidders with a fair opportunity to enter the bidding process, thereby stimulating competition in a manner conducive to sound fiscal practices. It'll help eliminate favoritism, fraud, and corruption in the awarding of public contracts. And that's all good. The next section, 101, says California public contract law should be efficient and the product of the best of modern practice and research. And that's where we see a bit of a tension because a lot of the more innovative and modern approaches to contracting are not found within the provisions of the Public Contract Code that apply to executive branch agencies and departments. For example, the more liberal methodologies that can be employed in contracting that the University of California system, the Cal State University and College system, the many special districts are able under the law to utilize are not available to judicial branch entities by virtue of how the judicial branch contract law is drafted. It was difficult, to be candid, to apply the state contracting manual and the state administrative manual provisions to judicial branch entities. It's difficult because with those two manuals that are developed by and for the executive branch, the roles, responsibilities, and activities of DGS run throughout those manuals. And in sharp contrast with our new law, DGS does not have a role to play. So in trying to implement the law and do what it says, have our manual be substantially similar to those executive branch manuals, it was not an easy task. But we met the challenge with the help of the working group comprising representatives from the trial courts mainly and representative from the appellate courts and then HCRC, who came together as a working group to help us in the process of developing the content of this manual in very, very short time frame. We, as I said, the law was enacted in late March. In May, we discussed the new requirements with the courts at the regional meetings, and then at SEAC, we requested SEAC's assistance in helping us pull together a working group. We were gratified with the response, and we have been working on it virtually nonstop from that time until now. The process was largely to identify the applicable public contract code provisions and then to cross-check them with the state contracting manual and the state administrative manual to see where in those manuals there were implementing provisions that tied back to the public contract code requirements, and then to draft provisions that were substantially similar and still made sense for judicial branch entities and their contracting activities. The manual, now turning to the content of the manual, it has an introduction, and the introduction, I'll get into the content of the introduction in a moment. It has 12 separate chapters, and it has appendices to some of those chapters that contain tools that the judicial branch entities can use, worksheets to calculate what needs to be calculated in some instances, and a whole lot of model contract provisions, both general terms and conditions and special terms and conditions that can be utilized by the courts and others as they shift their practices in terms of their structuring their contracts. And then the last part of the manual is a glossary of terms used and acronyms. Turning now to the introduction itself, it starts by referencing the statutory basis for the manual so that those procurement officers and other personnel in courts and other judicial branch entities who actually have to do the hands-on work, when they pick up the manual and open it up, it will inform them as to why this manual exists, what it is intended to do, and what the guiding principles are. It also addresses the use of terminology throughout the manual, because our consciousness has been heightened about the importance of distinguishing between language such as you must do something, language such as you should do something, and language such as you may do something. And what we've endeavored to do is to use the mandatory language must when, in fact, it is a legal requirement. And so we have a chart in the introduction that lays out the terminology and what it means and what kind of compliance or attention need to be paid to the terminology. So, again, we try to separate out between requirements versus what could be referred to as best practices. In the next slide, and what we're going to do is, because our view is you really need to know what this document is that we're asking you to approve, so we do want to go through quickly, if we can, each chapter, what the content is, and why it's part of the manual that we're proposing. So the first chapter, Chapter 1, is the purchasing authority chapter, and it is based primarily on Chapter 1 of the State Contracting Manual in both Volumes 2 and 3. And it identifies the sources of judicial branch entity authority to engage in procurement. Because unlike the executive branch agencies, which are required pretty much to use DGS's services, each court has its own independent authority to contract, as does the HCRC and as does the council and through its staff agency, the AOC. And so we wanted that to be clear. We also, in this chapter, identify the roles and responsibilities of personnel in those judicial branch entities with regard to procurement. So there's references to the types of personnel, procurement officer and others who have defined responsibilities to engage in procurement and contracting. And we're mindful of the fact that we're trying to have a manual that would be workable for the smallest two-judge court with, you know, fewer than a dozen staff members to Los Angeles. Not an easy task, but we tried to make it as scalable, if you will, so that it'll be a useful and workable document for all of the courts. The second chapter is about procurement planning. Again, it's based primarily on portions of the state contracting manual. And because the executive branch approach to contracting differentiates among non-IT goods, non-IT services, and IT goods and services, the three different categories of procurement types, this chapter of the manual notes that and explains and guides in terms of the planning that should precede any actual procurement activity so that those staff in courts and elsewhere that have to implement this new law and work under the new manual will know in the first instance how that the planning part is important and how to go about doing that. This does reflect, incidentally, a difference between how the judicial branch has engaged in contract and procurement up to this point in time. The trial courts, under the guidance of the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual, the AOC under our own procurement rules, which don't differentiate among the types of procurement activities. But now under the new regime, since that's a requirement under the law that we follow those portions of the public contract code applicable to the executive branch, that's what we're doing here in this chapter, a little bit of planning. The next chapter addresses the socioeconomic and environmental programs that are applicable to the executive branch and now to us with regard to contracting. The main one is the Disabled Veterans and DVBE, Disabled Veterans Business Enterprise Program requirements, and the State Buy Recycled campaign program. So this chapter is devoted to those subjects. The next chapter is really the kind of the meat and potatoes of the competitive solicitation requirements. Because of the necessity to differentiate among the three different types of categories of procurements, this chapter has sort of the introductory chapter, chapter 4, and then it has 4A, 4B, and 4C, which deals with each of those three types of procurements. This chapter draws extensively from all three volumes of the State Contracting Manual, and it has step-by-step guidance and checklists for conducting procurements in each of those three categories. Next. Chapter 4 also includes the requirement of using the lowest responsible bidder methodology for non-IT goods procurement over $50,000. The method that courts and others have been using, which is the best value method, is not permitted under the new requirements for non-IT goods over $50,000. So that distinction is very clearly made in this chapter. Chapter 5 turns to non-competitively bid procurements, again, based on the state contracting manual, because there are categories of purchases that are not subject to the competitive bid requirements. For example, purchases under $5,000 are exempt, and there's also the sole source justification that exists under our current regime. It's also permissible under the new contract law. So that, again, that chapter deals with the sort of the flip side of Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is all the competitive requirements. Chapter 5, the fewer non-competitive bid procurement opportunities. Chapter 6 is deals with leveraged procurements. And these, actually, we find to be very, very useful, especially for the trial courts, because by leveraging procurements, you can piggyback on other public entities and nonprofit organizations' contracts. You can use master contracts, CMAS. You can develop your own leverage, you can engage in your own procurements and create the kinds of agreements that other courts can then take advantage of. So this is a very useful tool that we have in our little toolkit here. Chapter 7 deals with protests and post-award disputes. This is basically pulled from the existing portions of the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual. And one distinction here where we actually are doing something or proposing that something be done that's a little different from what's required under the State Contracting Manual is that as we've drafted this chapter, the protest and post-award dispute process is out there for all procurements as opposed to limiting it to the dollar thresholds that the State Contracting Manual has. So we could have gone that way, which would have had the effect of a certain category of procurement activity. If it was below a certain dollar threshold, there wouldn't be a protest and post-award dispute process. And we thought it would be more helpful for there to be a process in place so that if there are protests or disputes, irrespective of the precise dollar amount at issue, we would already have an established process that could be followed. But that is that reflects a policy issue that I wanted to flag for you. Chapter 8 is the chapter that is most dense in that it deals with the specifics of preparing, drafting, approving, and executing contracts. This is analogous to Chapter 8 of the Contract Manual, but the State Contracting Manual, but it also pulls from the Public Contract Code itself and from other chapters of the State Contracting and Administrative Manuals and from the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual. And this is one where we do have rather lengthy appendices with sample contract provisions. Chapter 9 deals with disbursements and payments. It's more detailed than the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual on progress payment requirements, so that it's more in line with the requirements that are found in the State Contracting Manual. And this is most, or rather with the I was going to say requirements, with the information in that manual, because the State Contracting Manual has a lot of stuff that's not specifically required. It's just information. And this is really more so a best practices kind of chapter, because our thought is that in order for it to be useful for courts especially, and especially the smaller and medium-sized ones that may not have a full-on procurement department, to have a manual that really is one-stop shopping for contracting that goes from the planning through the selection of the vendor to the execution of the contract to receiving the services and paying for them, that the whole having everything in one manual would be hopefully useful. In Chapter 10, we deal with the details of receiving and inspecting and accepting goods and services. And mostly in this chapter, there are best practices, not requirements. And the material in this chapter is consistent with the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual. Chapter 11 is contract administration. Again, it's pulled from the existing manual that the trial courts operate under. With regard to contract administration, and that it also includes some optional provisions from the State Contracting Manual. Chapter 12, that is our last chapter, is the chapter containing the reporting requirements that I made reference to earlier. It describes the council's obligations to report contract information to the JLBC, the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, and to the Bureau of State Audits. And it also describes each judicial branch entity's obligation to provide information to the AOC so that the AOC can then prepare the report for the council to approve in terms of submitting it as required by the statute. So that takes us through the content of the manual. If there aren't any questions about that, I would move to the recommendations that we are making, or I could talk about the recommendations and then go back and have discussion as you wish.
Judge Rosenberg.
Thank you. One quick question. Thank you for the presentation. The manual applies to goods and services. Will it apply to courts contracting with interpreters and reporters and private security? What about labor contracts?
Labor contracts, no, because labor contracts are covered by Trial Court Employment Protection and Governance Act. We've had this question before. I'm going to turn to my colleagues on either side of me to see what can we say about that.
And does it specifically, if it doesn't include them, exempt them, like construction contracts specifically exempted? Does it clearly say what's exempt?
No, there isn't. Well, there is no specific statutory exemption for those matters that you just described.
There are portions of the manual that would apply, generally speaking, the contracting provisions. However, for certain categories of service providers, such as court interpreters or court reporters, where the fees for those services are set either by the legislature or by the judicial council in the case of interpreters, we think that those should not have to be competitively bid, because if the fees are set, then you're not going to obtain a lower cost. And that is not specifically addressed in this version of the manual, but it's our intent to include language to that effect in the next version of the manual, which I believe that we're going to present in December.
I think it's very important for the 58 trial courts. I know the Judicial Council can figure this out all by itself, but for the 58 trial courts, it's very important that we put out at least a memo and let them know what's in and what's out. So I was just saying that it's really important that we put out this manual is 786 pages, so it's...
Actually, it's 275 approximately.
Whatever. It's
long. It just felt like that.
It felt like that when we were drafting it.
But I think we need a memo to the CEOs and PJs, which clearly lays out what's in and what's out.
Judge, you're absolutely right. We need a whole lot of stuff. We are racing as fast as we can to develop a number of tools, including a fact sheet, FAQs. And fortunately, we've getting questions. The courts aren't shy in lobbing the questions at us. And we're trying to harmonize other legal requirements from other statutes, like the interpreter statutes, harmonize them with these requirements under the Public Contract Code now. And we're endeavoring to do that in a way that makes sense. And that's why when we did the introduction to the manual, we identified those guiding principles. Because when push comes to shove, as we try to figure out how to make this work, we want to be able to look at what the legislative intent is behind the Public Contract Code, including that California public contract law should be efficient and the product of the best of modern practice and research. We don't want to go backwards, so we want this to be a useful, efficient, and sound document.
That's very nice. The legislative intent is important, but we just need a bright line. PJs and CEOs need a bright line. Tell us what's included. Tell us what's not included.
Understood. Thank
Helen
you.
Carlson?
Yeah, I'm... as you'll understand, pretty closely involved with this over the development, and my staff's been involved with, as a number of other courts. And what I'm going to say is not to reflect on the work that's been done. I think it's very useful, and there's a use for it, but not exactly what was presented initially to all of us. I see this body as a policy-making body, and I think the manual we should adopt should be a policy manual. What we've got here, and it's useful, but what we've got here is another court's purchasing officer called a desk reference, not a policy manual. So part of why the recommendation is to keep working on this is I think we need to revisit this and turn it into a manual that reflects the policy of the council, not a how-to, you might do this, consider this, here's an alternative kind of a document. So I think the other thing you have to remember is we can be audited against this manual. So the more that's in the manual, the more mistakes we're going to make on audits, intentionally or otherwise. And I just don't like putting the trial courts and the appellate courts in the position of saying, well, you're not doing this thing that says you should be doing, when I don't think it should have been in a manual that we approved as a council in the first place and put out there. So I have issues with that. I have issues with the tension. I think you resolve the tension by saying, let's take the intent of the legislature to have a modern procurement law and develop a modern procurement law. Having looked at the state manual and listened to my staff about this, the state manual, to be charitable, is an archaic document that's mostly barnacles. It's developed over a long period of time, and stuff has been added and pieced onto it, and this has been changed, and why IT is different from the rest of the stuff is not always clear sometimes. We have a great opportunity here to modernize the manual. And luckily, the statute says substantially similar and consistent with. It doesn't say identical to or just take the parts out and repeat them that are in the state manual. And I think we have an opportunity here, and we're stepping out to do this, to say, you know, here's a more modern way to do this. And I think we ought to do that when we revise this the next cycle around. The process of developing it involved the AOC folks, and they did a great job, and the staff worked really hard. It's interesting when my staff watches me grumble about this. I know how hard they worked to help get this to a good place. But there were no PJs except for Judge Edmund involved in the development of the manual, and the only way the CEOs were involved were secondarily. I mean, I had staff there, and they would come back and talk to me. PJs have sign-off authority in the trial courts on this thing. I mean, I like what you're saying about clear lines because your signature's on there, not mine, so to speak, although it's usually delegated. I think we need to have this vetted by the PJs and the court administrators, and there wasn't time for that now. And there wasn't time for that this time, but we need to do that in the next cycle. So I think the sense of the recommendations here is, having said all that, I recognize we've got to have something on October 1st. I don't want the state manual to apply to us on October 1st, mainly because our people would have to sort out what that means for us, and in a sense, we've already done that by developing this manual. So let's adopt this manual with the understanding that we're going to keep working on it and go to a more modern system. You have odd things in here. The state manual is intended for statewide procurement. I don't think they really contemplated Tehama or Plumas or somebody like that purchasing stuff and L.A. and medium-sized courts. So we need to construct a manual that makes sense for all the different sizes of courts we have. For example, the rule about what's the cutoff on best value versus it's got to be lowest bid. Frankly, probably 30 of our courts are always going to be under the best value standard because they don't ever have a contract that big that they get past the threshold. So the big courts are saddled with sometimes having to take a contract at lowest bid that isn't the best value. I don't think that's consistent with the statute. So that's why I'm arguing that we ought to go with where the recommendation is, and in particular get the PJs and the court administrators and the administrative PJs involved in the process.
Two things. I'm going to take that as a motion for number one. And I also want to point out, too, that several components to this. First, I want to commend the AOC for putting this together and in the way that you have and as quickly as you have, notwithstanding that it is a work in progress, but we need something in place before October 1st so our procurement isn't superseded by the state procurement manual, which doesn't really apply to us. And so the background on this, as you might want to know, is when we were looking at the $200 million cut to the budget in January and we were negotiating with where that would come, we received word that based on complaints about our spending, that there was an effort to bring the judicial branch into the public contract code. And again, my congratulations and respect for the AOC and Office of General Counsel and Office of Governmental Affairs for being in the Capitol trying to fight the application of the public contract code to judicial branch entities, because they don't compare such that the contract code can be laid upon us and it would apply. And so there was a lot of give and take and back and forth, and you're under, you're not, you're under, you're not. It changed every night in the phone calls that we had. Ultimately, the result was construction. That was the sort of negotiated resolution. Construction would not be in the public contracts code. But this was a directive by the legislature, in part because of allegations of our profligate spending, and this is what we had to do in a very short period of time for Mary and her team to go through the state contract manual and the public contract code and find out what applies so that we can make it applicable to us. So that's the background of how this is here, why it's in the condition it is, and why Alan Carlson has made the motion. And I echo all of your concerns about our procedure on this.
So, Alan, could you just then read what your motion is?
Yeah, if I'm making the motion, I would say on recommendation on number one about adopting the manual. I don't know why we have the last sentence to comply with the contract law. That's obvious, and it actually sounds like we're just doing it to comply, which I don't like. And then the first bullet under number two, I would add increased representation of presiding judges, court administrators, and small, medium, and large trial courts. That would be my motion if...
Be second
if I can do that.
Judge Wesley,
and item number three, though, too, with regards to legislation.
Oh, I'm fine with. Three. Let's go back. Yeah, with three and four.
Are you
or three.
Judge Water.
Are you moving that we adopt all the staff recommendations?
But with those changes that I
yeah,
had.
With those changes that you made.
One through four.
I only got three under three.
I would second.
We got. I seconded it already.
Okay, you already did. Thank you.
So it's recommendations 1, 2, and 3 with the additional language, as memorialized on our tape about looking forward, involving the PJs and CEOs, to amend to a better product by the second iteration of this manual. And I've heard a second by Judge Wesley. Judge Waters.
I just wanted to add some comments. I did wade through this contracting manual. I also spoke with Ms. Carter and Mr. Capelli, who were involved in the working group, and I want to share with you the high praise that they gave me for OGC staff, the three of you, and all the work that you did. There are concerns. They're pretty much along the lines of what Mr. Carlson's already mentioned. I think we need to reemphasize it. And Mary, you already did. Scalability is going to be crucial here, in recognition that we do have a variety of courts of different sizes. And I would say, because of the added costs to all courts in going into this new procurement process, maximum flexibility to the individual courts in selecting between what I call formal and informal methods should be one of our goals, particularly in this bad budget situation. But I didn't want to leave the room without telling you that with all that you have on your plate and this being added in, Ms. Carter and Mr. Capelli did have nothing but serious high praise for the work that you put into this.
Thank you, Judge. Nice to hear.
Justice Baxter?
I assume that this would be available in both hard copy and online form.
Yes, and it's going to go up online, and we haven't really thought through, Justice Baxter, the details about whether we ought to be printing and, you know, making it available in that way, but certainly if any courts want us to do that, we'd be happy to.
Right. My second question was, is this something that Justice Hill's committee would be interested in?
Yes.
In terms of
short answer.
procurements at the state level versus procurements at the county level for maintenance, et cetera?
Yes, for maintenance, not for construction, but for maintenance. And we have been in discussions with the Office of Court Construction and Management about that very issue, especially given the contracting activities that are happening at fast pace in that area.
Kim Turner.
Thank you, Chief.
I want to echo what some of my colleagues have said about the what I consider to be a fairly remarkable achievement on the part of you, Mary, and your staff to sift through, you know, thousands of pages of other documents and law to distill to a mere 275 pages a manual that will, you know, is at least a great starting point to serve the courts going forward. But I would also say that I do believe one of the comments that Alan Carlson made, I have a different view, and that is that while the Judicial Council is a policy-setting body, we have many manuals that the Council has some oversight on, for instance, the Trial Court Financial Policies and Procedures Manual, the Trial Court Records Manual, which do contain some procedures and some practice and process for the courts, which I think for our smaller courts is extremely helpful.
Could I just comment on that, please?
Yes,
the statute that imposes the obligation on the Council to adopt a manual explicitly states that the manual is to incorporate procurement and contracting policies and procedures. So it's not simply a policy manual. It's a policy and procedure manual.
Yes, thank you. And having said that, I would just also add that I agree with Alan that to whatever extent we have discretion and latitude to use modern, progressive, forward-thinking practices, of course we want to use those. We don't want to be married to the, you know, the best procurement manual money could buy in 1952. But to the same extent, I think that, you know, your charge, Mary, is to make sure that we don't run afoul of the requirements in the new law. And when you read substantially similar and the other terms that you referenced at the beginning of your presentation, I understand why you took the approach that you took, and I think within certain parameters, and I hope with the help of CEOs and PJs in the continuing efforts to refine the manual and so forth, that maybe, and perhaps even with additional help from OGA, we can maybe get some clarification that will enable us to move forward in a way that will you know, enhance the product and make it easier for courts to use those modern practices.
Thank you.
I also want to recognize what I think counsel and what I think the committees do best, and that is with great thanks and respect to Los Angeles, Judge Wesley, for Judge Edmund's involvement in this and helping to create this, as well as Alan Carlson and your office on this for, with your folks on trying to figure out something that we can put together that's useful to the courts in well before the deadline.
Thank you, Chief. I'll pass that on to Judge Edmund. Thank you.
So without hearing further discussion, all in favor of the recommendations as stated, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No opposed. Matter passes. Thank you.